one explanation. This is not to be confused with Jackie Gleason's coffee. This is cold tea provided for me by Roe.
Questions and discussion?
Well, now, my opinion is the most important thing that we can do for the Negro struggle is first to put it in this general perspective and see it as a part of the American Revolution and not something standing by itself separate. I think that's the first thing, to think about it as an element in the ferment making for an American revolution of the working class as a whole. Don't forget, the Negroes are practically all workers. They're a part of the working class. Secondly, to recognize the tremendous progressive aspect of the development among the Negroes for self-identification. They attempt to throw off the restricting leadership of the conservative organizations with white philanthropists and liberals calling the shots and developing their own organizations and their own leadership, encouraging that in every way and recognizing its progressive nature. And the third thing is to remember that our task also is to work among the white workers in defense of the Negro cause, to beat down their prejudice and convince them that the Negro struggle is an ally of the general working class movement leading to the revolution. And they must learn to cooperate. And I foresee that the next stage of development will be the most advanced and militant workers forming their own organizations with their own selected leadership and then coming to realize they can't do it all. I personally do not believe that's possible, and I think it is misleading the American Negroes to encourage them in the idea that 10% of the population, and you haven't got 10%, because a tremendous percentage of the Negroes are not involved in the struggle, particularly the middle class, the petty bourgeois, and professional elements, can do it all alone. They'll do it in union with the American workers and the unionists, but not as in the past, simply by joining and becoming anonymous members. I foresee a united front in which the Negroes will have their own organizations, their own leadership, and a united front with white organizations that have the same objective. For example, I foresee in the near future the beginning of a tremendous unemployment movement. Oh my God, you've got already 10 million. In no time at all, you're going to have 15 or 20 million. And they're not all Negroes, a considerable percentage, but the majority will be whites. I foresee the formation of militant, unemployed organizations of white teenagers and others coming together with similar organizations of Negroes led by Negroes in a united front to begin some action which will make these riots look like a tea party. And that will only be a beginning. Then we'll begin banging on the doors of the unions, demanding they get into action to help, not as they The labor skates foresee it. They will set up committees to lead the unemployed. Like hell they will. The unemployed are going to lead themselves if we have anything to say about it. And we're going to force the labor unions into line because with the increasing overproduction, the minute there's a lag in the market, they'll begin closing down production. And if the lesson of the previous depression of 1929 to 1939 is any indication, they'll begin pressure on wages, one thing and another. And these supposedly dormant, apathetic, highly contented, and immovable 17.5 million workers organized in unions are never going to move, I think is a very absurd conception. The minute the pressure begins to put upon their living standards, they're going to begin to be responsive to action and to the most radical action. Unless you've participated in a big spontaneous strike or two, or in a revolution such as Cuban, you have no idea how quickly men and women can change and become transformed in action. Everybody who writes from Cuba writes about the tremendous elan of people turning out by the million to celebrate the revolution. People who 10 years ago had their backs bowed were completely apathetic. The revolution brought them to life. I've seen that happen in more strikes than one. They're just ordinary church-going workers who just went along taking the guff from day to day and year to year until something finally sparked. They cut wages once too often, or they got a little too tough in one department, and a group started a strike and it spread. And you see those workers out on the streets, and you see the wobbly agitators who would be in there in no time at all on every freight train route leading to the city. And our strategy was to get them all in a big mass meeting first and give them a big rousing series of speeches about the necessity of fighting the whole damn system, not merely this boss of this company, but the workers themselves should rule the world. And you'd be surprised how they all responded as if they just heard a revelation. And don't cross off 17.5 million organized American workers. They're there. What they need is a little squeeze. And if you see any of them, give them my personal assurance the squeeze is coming.
Now let's have some speeches there while I catch my breath.
Yeah. You brought up a fact, an element of what you just said about churches. Ministers have churches have a lot of influence over a lot of people. Yeah. How do you think this is going to interfere in any kind of way?
I think, personally, now, I want you to understand I'm not pontificating here. I'm expressing opinions in what's supposed to be a think session. And anybody's perfectly free to take a different point of view, a personal opinion. The church plays a different role in the Negro community than it does in other communities. The modern church in the white community is by and large a sort of social status institution. I don't think you have a great deal of religion. What you have is religiosity. People go to church because it's the proper thing to do. That's where people, you make contacts for business deals. It's a social center. The percentage of people that are worried about their souls, I personally think is not so great as it used to be. But even among the poor, who are more religious than the middle class and the well-to-do, even they, the people I was talking about in the strikes that I have known in the past, They were rank-and-file people who really took the church rather seriously, but they people find a way of reconciling their religion to the necessities of their personal situation in the most remarkable manner. You know what the Catholic Church teaches? If thy neighbor smite thee on one cheek, turn to him the other. But Bill Haywood used to say, an Irish Catholic on the picket line is worth a dozen parliamentary socialists. He forgets all about it until he's beat the hell out of as many scabs as he can handle. And then a month later he goes to confession and gets it all cleared up. But the church among the Negro people, as one of the heritages from slavery, that's the only meeting place they had. That's their social center. That's their life. And the church plays a much bigger role among the Negro people, not so much as a religion, as I would say a social center. They gotta meet somewhere. Where do they meet? They got a church, or they got a brotherhood of elks or something like that, or they got a fraternal order for providing for burial privileges, and that's about it. Of their own. They join unions. They're mixed up with white people. They work. They're mixed up with white people. The only place of their own is the churches. Now, I also take with a grain of salt this preachment of nonviolence. That can be partly religious inspired and partly a protective coloration while they're weak. Even the Wobblies were nonviolent when they were in a minority. They practiced all the things. Here's a remarkable thing. All the things that the civil rights movement are doing practically were done by the Wobblies. But they didn't preach. They just practiced. They just practiced passive resistance. But once you let them get an even break with the cops or anybody else, they forget all about that. because it was not a part of their doctrine, it was the tactic. It was the tactic. Nonviolence as a tactic, and I'm glad to see, it's interesting to see how through various cracks and crevices, one way or another, changes and modern recognition makes its appearance. Take the difference between CORE and the NAACP. The CORE is more of an action organization than the NAACP, which doesn't take part in any actions if they can avoid it. When it gets really big enough, Roy Wilkins has to go to Birmingham to get himself arrested in order to call attention to his existence. But the job was done by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is an action organization with a facade, whether real or protective coloration, of nonviolence. But the SNCC goes a step further. They talk of nonviolence not as a principle but as a tactic, don't they? That's a step further. And you'll soon have developing among the Negro people, especially among the youth, a more deliberate policy. Be nonviolent while you're in a majority, but when you get a chance, put in a few licks. That'll help.
Jamie?
I'd like to ask, how will it be possible for us in the near future to influence the existing black nationalist group or the black nationalist vanguard to our politics from our relatively isolated?
Well, it won't be easy, but you print in your paper. You print in your paper your analysis, your thinking, not merely reporting, not merely supporting. That's not the role for Marxists. The Marxists are supposed to analyze. And I have no state like these articles of Brightman. They are read by the leaders of the nationalist movement. I personally don't like that word nationalist. I think it's more of a convenience than anything else. I consider the so-called nationalist movement, it's a struggle for self-identification. They're not going to go to Africa like the Garveyites propose. And they're not going to ask for a few million acres of desert to be turned over to them to exploit. They're going to solve their problem where the only place they can solve it is right where they are, in the United States and in the great cities. And they got to do it in cooperation with militant white workers. And we will influence it above all by our ideas. Don't forget that. Don't forget that above all. Our party is an action machine. It's an efficient machine, but first of all, in the tradition of Marxism, it's a think machine. And we have to analyze every problem in the light of reality and exchange opinions with others. And it's not without significance, you know, that they read The Militant, that Malcolm X even recommends The Militant. And it's not simply because we report their struggle sympathetically. It's because we have things to say that they may not have thought about yet. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that you're going to build a revolutionary movement from nothing without regard to the past. Why, God Almighty, there's over 100 years of Marxist thought behind us. We have to, and when we draw on that, draw upon all the experience of the past and generalize from it, we not only have a tremendous advantage over other political tendencies that want to start from scratch, we also render a great service to those who are just beginning. And the first thing a young militant who suddenly decides this whole damn system has got to go, that's what the SNCC people mean when they say the power structure, this system's got to go down. They haven't learned to say the capitalist system. But when you stop to think that if the civil rights movement secured every demand so far published, right to eat a hamburger and any greasy spoon in the country, the right to sleep in the Beverly Hills Hotel if you can pay for it, the right to ride in a bus if you got a ticket, what are a few other little things? The right to vote in the Democratic primary in the police state of Mississippi. The right to have 2 delegates at large in a capitalist party convention. You get all that, and what do you got? The capitalists have still got all the industries. They've got all the banks. They've got the railroads. And they've got the military. So don't get over enthusiastic about the achievements of the civil rights movement. It's just getting started and feeling its way. And one of the ways it's got to feel, in my opinion, is how and under what conditions can the militant Negroes find a way to have a dignified and effective and autonomous association with white workers who want to clear this system off the face of the earth. I think that'll be the beginning of wisdom.
Vince?
I think the comrade posed a question of tactics the Negro people generally are not prepared to receive the message of socialism unvarnished in its own language. It looks to me like the SNCC people are working their way around that, and they're a good example. You know, the Manifesto of the First International written by Marx, he said he left some things out of it because the workers at that time were not yet prepared to hear it. But you work out concrete programs which lead toward it. Snick speaks more and more about this whole power structure. This whole system has got to be changed in Mississippi and Alabama and so on. That's could be a transition, and programs of demands which lead toward the revolution. That's the significance of the transition program of the Fourth International, that sets up a series of demands which correspond to the thinking of the workers at the moment and can be received by them without demanding that they join the Trotskyist party. Like the slogan of the sliding scale of hours. A demand for a shorter working day is a revolutionary demand today. It can lead to other things. Throughout the world, one of the central problems of the revolutionary Marxists is precisely that working out transition demands, which in themselves do not go beyond the possible acceptance of the workers at the moment, and yet inevitably lead toward a further clash, a further collision. So I would say, this is a personal opinion, I would say that the task of the civil rights movement, the militant elements, is begin working out a series of demands that go beyond the piddling reforms so far endorsed by the NAACP and the Democratic Party and others. The people who wrote the Triple Revolution managed to put the most revolutionary demands in their document without saying a word about socialism. The demand that if you can't give people work, you've got to give them compensation. It's your responsibility. I believe if our party and the unemployed Negroes would demand, you give us either work or give us compensation fit to live on. It's a just demand. They got money enough to do it. And it will find widespread acceptance among deprived people, and that'll lead to still stiffer demands, in my opinion. I personally am in favor of the demand of the document called the Triple Revolution, that everybody is entitled to work or compensation. And I don't mean dole or dribbles of welfare benefits that just keep you on the verge of starvation. But you're entitled to compensation to live as a human being in the present affluent society. And I would organize a big campaign around that. I think you'd find the Negroes responsive to that. They're entitled to it. They're human beings. There's plenty there. All you just count. Jesus Christ, General Motors alone made enough profits to keep half the country, half the people living comfortably for a year. It's not unreasonable. The thing is to break out of the format of just asking for piddling things. Begin to ask for more drastically. Demand either better places to live in or no rent until they're fixed. Well, they're approaching that with their rent strike and others. But if they got some assurance that this is a legitimate demand, and that the white militants are going to support it to the hilt and are going to demand it for themselves. Don't forget there's an awful lot of poor white people in this country, too. They're not all in the affluent society. Not by a long shot. There's plenty of ground for united front. Now, while I'm at it, I want to pay a tribute to the Communist Party. The first time I've been able to do this for a long time. Going back to the central theme with which we begun, that we're here to think and to discuss, not to make any decisions, just to think and discuss and see if out of the thinking and the discussion and the questioning we can come to some conclusions which will help the party to be more effective in its action and its efficiency. The latest issue of Political Affairs, that's the so-called theoretical journal of the Communist Party, has an entire edition for August devoted to the subject of automation and social change, and every article in it is a comment on the document, The Triple Revolution. And the opening editorial shows a big swing around. When this was first came out, the Daily Worker printed it, and then it was followed up by a snippy sectarian article dismissing the whole business as utopian and so on. They've come to realize that there's more to it than that. And their editorial beginning has the heading, Automation is New. Now, I think that's a very pregnant sentence. All of our thought about automation should be, automation is new. And it is introducing qualitative changes in the relation of the workers toward the productive process. And from that, we certainly got to draw some political conclusions. In my lectures 12 years ago in Los Angeles on the America's Road to Socialism, in the latter part of the book speaking about the socialist society, I predicted that there would be continuing improvement in the productive process. And I used the expression I had forgotten about till it was called to my attention the other day, that a new industrial, technological, scientific revolution will speed up the process of reducing the hours of labor time necessary for a man to produce all he needs in his lifetime, until the idea of an 8-hour day or even a 4-hour day will become an absurdity. There's nothing for him to do. And that people will work themselves around to the idea, as I suggested, maybe a couple of years of work at an 8-hour day in a young man's life would be sufficient to produce all that he will need in the way of material goods for the rest of his life. And they might elect to go into labor services. Now they're drafted into military service for 2 years and get it over with and spend the rest of their life in study, in music, in art, or just fooling around, whatever they want to do. They're entitled to it. They're entitled to it. They've already made their contribution to society. And I congratulate the Communist Party on recognizing the fact that I predicted this under socialism. Now, the ad hoc committee on the Triple Revolution has told us that even under capitalism, without waiting for us to make the socialist revolution, has begun to introduce a new revolution, which is even more profound, perhaps, in its significance than the original Industrial Revolution. Not merely an extension of the Industrial Revolution, but a new leap of such proportions that it has to be called new, the cybernetic revolution. I'm in favor of that and all the benefits that will accrue from it. And I'm still more in favor of all our party comrades thinking about that and helping the party work out a program of demands and activities adjusted to the automation revolution. I think that's enough, isn't it? Unless somebody wants to make a speech.
Yeah,
some comrades want to speak.
Bill?